Reheated Cabbage is the title of Irvine Welsh's collection of stories published recently. Now, the title makes the nose crease a bit, although I do love sauerkraut. Was there a story by this name in the index, I thought? Well, actually, no, there isn't. Surely the author of these previously published or long ago written or not published stories wouldn't want to call a collection of old stuff Reheated Cabbage. Perhaps, but not if the writer is Irvine Welsh, the author of Trainspotting, because Irvine Welsh calls a spade a spade. He's been in Australia as a guest of the Perth and Adelaide Writers Festivals, and he's doing various other appearances across the country. But he's in Melbourne now on the book show. Irvine Welsh, welcome to the book show.
Thank you very much, Ramona.
So why call a collection of stories like this Reheated Cabbage? I mean, is this truth in advertising, or is there something deeper about revisiting work from long ago?
I thought I'd get in and kind of self-harm before the critics got a hold of me.
Why?
What it was is that Reheated Cabbage is it's actually an Italian term that they use for a kind of... when people who are in a relationship kind of they split up, then they get back together. I forget the actual Italian phrase, but you know, roughly translated, it means reheated cabbage, and it's always seen as a kind of bad idea, basically. So it was kind of me just thinking about the double-edged sword of kind of revisiting sort of these old stories and getting them back together again. I wasn't quite convinced it was a good idea, but. So many of them have kind of, you know, I like quite a few of them, and they've gone out of print in the anthologies and magazines they've been in over the years. So I wanted to get them under one roof again, I suppose.
So you weren't convinced it was a good idea. Someone is obviously trying to convince you.
Yeah, well, I always think that I don't like going back and looking, you know, so when you're pulling back a collection together, you kind of... you have to go back and look through old stuff, and I don't really like going back and looking through old stuff. Once I've written something that's kind of gone, I just go on to the next thing. And I'd done some new stories fairly recently, a couple of years before that, called If You Like School, You Love Work, and I enjoyed doing them. And I thought, do I really want to go back and sort of go through all this this old stuff? But I kind of did enjoy it once I got into doing it.
It sort of sounds like someone saying, you'll like this if you taste it.
Well,
often publishers do say, we want a book to appear every so often, and if your book isn't ready yet or the next novel isn't ready, what about this idea? Is that the sort of pressure you're under when you're such a well-known name in the literary world?
I don't think so. I think it's the other way around, really. I think if you're writing, and I suppose it might be different if you're doing genre fiction, if you're doing something like a thriller or a crime novel or a romance or something that where you have a kind of franchise and you have to keep it going. But it's the sort of stuff I do. It's the pressure's really doesn't really exist in terms of publishing. The publishers are always very good about things. In some ways, maybe often too good. You know, they don't really kind of crack the whip. Most of my kind of motivation is my kind of targets are self-generated, you know, so... I kind of feel that I'm always working on some things, but, I've always got something on the go, and I feel that if I hold on to something too long, I start to get a bit fed up with it, and I kind of really want to get rid of it and let it go, and then I make that big push to finish it as a book. I've had a book a year out recently, and that's probably a bit too much for the kind of stuff that I do. This one I'm taking my time with, and the new one I'm doing. So hopefully that'll be out next year sometime.
Well, when you say you don't like to look at the stories that you've done already, is that because you want to edit them? Is that because you want to...
Yeah, it's never, a book's never finished, it's basically when you can't stand it any longer, you give it up.
Well, someone just takes it from you.
Or someone takes it off you, or but it's never ever finished. So you kind of only see the flaws and you only see things you would have done differently. And I think with this, this Reheated Cabbage book, it's so much of it's from the 90s, and nobody kind of likes to be confronted with a younger self, you know what I mean? It's kind of...
Why? What do you see?
I don't know. I don't like looking at old photographs, and I don't like looking at the stuff that I've kind of I've done. It's just... I think you're aware that you're kind of going through a certain sort of way of thinking, a certain mode, and a certain kind of set of attitudes at the time, but it's not necessarily what you kind of feel now. And I think kind of sometimes it's quite a shock to think about how much you've changed and how much the writing would have changed.
It's interesting because that's not to say you don't like revisiting old themes or themes that you have written about before. In fact, I believe that the new book is a prequel to Trains.
Yeah.
So not the same thing. I don't want to think about anything I used to think about. I want to think about it as I am now.
Yeah, in a kind of different way. I mean, I think that when I first wrote Trainspotting, for example, I mean, I had like 300,000 words, kind of much too long. And so I basically chopped out the middle part of it and tacked on this heist ending and then, you know, sent it off as a book. And the last part of it, section that I didn't use, I was able to kind of work into other stories. But this first section of about 100,000 words has been lying there for years and years, and it's kind of it's basically how, you know, the transformation of the characters from being kind of nice young guys who did their own thing, sort of, to being hardcore drug addicts. And that transformation part of it, about the community they lived in, the society they lived in, the family dynamics and relationships they had, that actually didn't really interest me that much at the time when I wrote Trainspotting as a much younger guy. I was just much more interested in the culture they were in and showing that culture, that subculture, not to how they got to that point. And I think when you get older and you become more reflective, that your priorities start to change, and I'm much more interested in that period in their lives now.
I am just looking at Reheated Cabbage. The first story, A Fault on the Line, is a really tough, violent story. But the last story, I Am Miami, which seems to I was just interested to know when that was written, because there seems to be a real movement in the sensibility. I Am Miami is really about what happens when an old teacher is met again by these young guys who he used to be really down on them and think they were scum, and it turns out that they respected him in a funny kind of way, and it changes really his view of them. Well, I'm not sure whether they really did respect him, but they did drug him.
Yeah,
but,
I mean,
but it just seems to be a movement there.
I think that moment is like, it's basically about the it's about kind of people kind of you know, taking these entrenched positions and all that, and finding out that, you know, that as life moves on, that the kind of the kind of adversarial thing that they had between them isn't really that important. You know, it's that their common humanity is much more important, and the shared experience is much more important than the kind of the kind of conflict that they had. But it takes, you know, it often takes a lot, you know, in terms of individuals, in terms of like kind of the bigger world. You know, it takes a lot to get to that point where we can actually see that, because we're kind of blinded by our own conflicts at the time.
So this last story, where did that come from? Because you've got some common characters there.
Yeah, I wrote a novel called Glue. I think it came out in 1999, which I kind of really liked. And basically, I'd sort of I thought about the characters there and the relationship with the school teacher, and I thought a couple of years later, you know, what would it be like if they actually met this guy? And I just wrote this long story. It was like probably an extended sort of chapter in Glue that was never used in a way. And I just wrote this kind of long postscript story, but I couldn't really do anything with it because I kind of, novellas are funny. There's no market for them. You can't publish them as a novel, and you can't put them in a sort of anthology or a magazine as a short story because they're too lengthy. So basically, I think that was actually one of the principal motivations for kind of getting this collection together, was that I wanted this novella to go into print, and it was the only way I could think of doing it.
So when you go back to things and back to characters, in fact, do you feel like it's more like creating a whole world?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the actual the character's gatecrash. I mean, it's you kind of what I hate in books is that when a writer writes the same character every book, and they just call him by a different name. Basically, it really irritates me. You know, it's like kind of they might change their hair color, or they might give them a moustache or something, but they're essentially the very same character. And what I've found, you know, when I write, you find that the character, you know, you find that the person's got. The story you're trying to tell, there's a character that just slots into it. For example, when I was doing Porno, which became the follow-up to Trainspotting, I had the character of Sick Boy just gate-crashed into that book. He wasn't originally called Sick Boy in the first drafts, and then I realised, God, that's just Sick Boy kind of 10 years on. So you have to make a virtue of necessity, or people are just going to say that guy looks exactly like Sick Boy, but he seemed to be the best character for the job.
Well, I'm speaking with Irvine Welsh here on The Book Show on ABC Radio National. You're with Ramona Koval. And you're living now mainly, not in Edinburgh, but you're about to move to Chicago, but you have been in Dublin and Miami Beach for a few years. And in your last novel, Crime, that's set in Miami Beach. You say in the thank yous at the end of the book that your wife Elizabeth helped you by telling you your first draft was crap.
Yeah, she did.
How did you receive news like this?
Terrible. You know, it's kind of not really what it's not really what you wanted. But I mean, she was right. I mean, but she was a bit more. I mean, I'm being unfair to her. She was a bit more specific about it. She said, you know, she told me why she thought it wasn't sort of working, basically. And it's, I mean, it's like you're going to hear that somewhere along the line. You know, she read it first, and then it's like, but if she hadn't said it, I would have heard it from my editor, or whatever. So it's all going to. The bad news is never kind of you're never going to avoid the bad news, and you need it. You know, you need to hear that something isn't working, and every writer does. Otherwise, you put out something that just isn't up to standard, and nobody wants that.
Did you suspect that was the case when you handed it over?
No, I was kind of quite. I think the problem is when you're writing a book, you've only got yourself, and you kind of if you get excited about something, you can tend to kill your own critic. So I think this is one of the reasons why I'm kind of trying to take a bit longer with this now, so that I'm coming back, you know, sticking it in a drawer for a while and coming back to it as a stranger. I mean, all the things that when I teach creative writing classes, it's all the things that I tell people to do. You know, I'm actually going to start doing them myself.
So she must be a brave woman, your wife, to say that to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, she knows I'm scared of her, so it's it doesn't take much bravery on her part, yeah.
This is the bad boy of Scottish literature talking. Why don't we hear a reading from the prelude to this book, and then I wanted to talk about it. So this is the prelude to the book, Crime.
Okay, this is The Storm. She wanted to tell Mama that this one was no good, like the one back home in Mobile. And that bastard in Jacksonville. But her mama was doing her eyes in front of the mirror and was telling her to hush and make sure that all the shutters was fastened, because I reckoned the storm was going to be blowing in from the northeast tonight. The girl went to the window and looked out. All was calm. The shining disk of a moon pulsed blue light into the apartment. It was broken only by the limbs of the dead oak tree in the yard outside, spreading keen varicose shadows, creeping across the walls, dark and vital. Snipping down the spring catch to secure a slatted wooden barrier, mindful of pain fingers past, she strategically pulled her hand back, thinking of it as a smart mouse stealing cheese from a trap. Then she regarded the vacant intensity of her mother in the mirror's reflection. She used to like to watch Mama fix herself up, all pretty, the way she would really concentrate with that little brush and make those big lashes dark. Not now, though. Something sour curdled in her stomach. "Don't go out tonight," the girl said softly, somewhere between wishing and begging. Her mother's small pink tongue darted out, wetting her eye pencil. "Don't worry about me, baby. I'll be okay." And then a car horn blared from downstairs and the thermostat clicked on the aircon, making it colder in the room. They both knew it was him. "Lucky this apartment's got them shutters," her mama said, rising and picking her bag up from the table. She kissed the daughter on the head. Pulling away, her big made-up eyes stared at the kid. "Remember, bed before 11. I'll probably be back around then, but if I get held up, I want you asleep, young lady." Then she was gone. For a while, the girl had the glowing pool from the television screen to make things safe within its field by bathing them in its soft, murky light. But beyond its scope, she sensed something lurking, coming closer. A balmy eastern wind rapped with firm insistence on the shutter, ominous enough to be the harbinger of a more malign force. The rain started a few outstretched heartbeats later, at first slowly pitter-pattering on the windows. Then she could hear the wind twisting and whipping. The distressed black arms of the tree signalled frantically. Suddenly a cannon of thunder roared, and somewhere outside an object crashed to earth and shattered. Yellow light flared the room in a sulphurous glow for a full 3 seconds. The girl turned the handset up as the tempest raged on, the wind and rain thrashing at the window. After a bit, she retreated timidly to bed, scared of the darkness she tentatively journeyed through, but more afraid to prolong the agony by searching for a light switch. Unable to sleep, she knew it was late when she heard the door downstairs click open and feet clop on the stone steps outside. The digital clock on her table burned 2:47 in accusation. She prayed it would be one set of footsteps. His were always so soft, he never wore anything but sneakers. But then she heard the voices and the muffled laughter. Her mama would sleep soundly with the pill she was on, right through the storm. But she would have to face it. Pulling her nightdress down and gripping its hem with a handful of bedclothes, the girl braced herself.
Irvine Welsh there, reading from Crime here on ABC Radio National on The Book Show. That's a really creepy beginning, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's a really creepy story. But it's a book that follows a policeman, Detective Inspector Ray Lennox, who appeared in your previous book, Filth, I think. He goes to Miami to escape the trauma of a child sex murder case in Edinburgh. He brings with him his fiancée, who's interested in having a holiday and planning a wedding. He gets involved with another child abuse case. Research for the novel Crime, you say you chose for obvious reasons not to trawl the internet for this stuff. That would be a recipe for getting a knock on your door, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like kind of... It's a very dangerous thing to do. I mean, but apart from the kind of, I wasn't really interested in sort of in paedophiles and their sex, their sexual practices and all. And I was more interested in survivors and how they kind of psychologically survived something like that. And so I spent most of the research was actually meeting survivors groups of child sex abuse. Which is kind of a very, very harrowing thing to do. I mean, and the kind of scary thing is that when people are telling you about their experiences, that they're just so matter of fact about it. You know, about these horrible things that have happened to them. Usually when they're small kids or young kids, and they're just sitting, telling you in a very matter of fact way, and it's just so, so difficult to listen to. But that was, basically the book was the book's actually about how people heal themselves. Really, it's a book about kind of getting over something that's really horrible happened to you, rather than about kind of wallowing in the kind of minutiae of the detail of something terrible that's happened to you.
Why choose this for a subject for you?
I don't know. I mean, I think to me, it's one of the things that's like, I think as a novelist, like, you're always looking for stuff that's really right out there, material that's kind of that's difficult to deal with. And this is one of the things that's right on the fringes of our human experience, and it kind of challenges me to as a writer to try and make some sense of something like that. And of course, you can't to an extent, but you can try and you can look at how people how people negotiate and come to terms with it and survive it. And that was that was something that kind of that interested me, and it's kind of organic in a way as well, because the character Lennox was a minor character in a previous book, Filth, but he always seemed to me then to be a kind of a character of secrets, and he was very quite a silent sort of background character, and he just seemed to suit that kind of role, and this whole thing about like child sex abuse and any kind of sex abuse kind of basically thrives on sort of secrecy and people not speaking out and people not coming forward, and that whole silence around cultural silence around it, and so I think that that was Lennox seemed to be the kind of guy who would. He would have had his own issues and had his own things to deal with that would have made him empathetic with the plight of the victims and sufferers of sex abuse.
There's also a sort of sense that the idea of parents protecting children and parents being aware of what they are introducing their children to, especially in that whole recreational drug area where you've written about that for a long time. It's almost like you're thinking about, maybe what happens to those children who are born into that milieu.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think in general, I mean, it's. I think it's a much tougher life for kids now. I mean, it's one of the things that the book's also kind of trying to look at is the way that kind of childhood's been stolen by adults. That the increased kind of the sexualization of children, the way that children are kind of basically. Not allowed to kind of play together now without kind of adults kind of supervision, and even the culture, the culture of childhood, the way it's fetishized by adults, the way that the things about childhood are stolen by adults now. I mean, you look
like
at
what?
Well, Harry Potter is a perfect example. I mean, that's something that kids should be reading and enjoying, but it's become, it was basically a series of books for kind of for very kind of. For very bright kids and very thick adults who've kind of fetishized childhood and can't let go of you just can't let go of the fact that they're not children anymore. I mean,
so these are the thick adults who read the Harry Potter series.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the whole kind of. I mean, it's part of the whole cult of worshipping youth and kind of, but also this kind of the way that I think with adults now, and with some justification that we feel that. The big problems and issues of the world are so overwhelming. There's nothing we can do about them. We feel that we haven't been able to, we've bought into all these different kind of ideologies over the last kind of sort of half century, and we haven't been able to sort the world out at all. Nothing's really much has happened. So, I think it's basically some kind of retreat into infantilism going on. This willful not engaging with the problems of the world, and I think that's kind of part of it. But I don't think it. I don't think it does kids any good because it's basically muscled them out of their territory.
What sort of a child were you?
I think I think that basically, you're very similar as a child. You're just it's a kind of younger self. Basically, it's just the very same as you are as an adult. I mean, I can't. I don't think. I don't feel as if it was any different from any other kids kind of sort of growing up. Maybe a bit kind of precocious sometimes, but it's difficult to say. I mean,
precocious about reading or?
Yeah, but I was a bit gabby and chatty and cheeky and opinionated, I think.
Who did you think you knew better then?
Everybody.
Teachers, parents?
Yeah, basically everyone, but teachers, parents, everyone kind of still do, really. Mm. But
except for me.
Yeah, except for you. You can. Yeah. But I mean, I think it's just something that you kind of. Your basic personality is your basic personality, and I don't think you sort of. I don't think that changes in any way.
This idea that Irvine Welsh, the enfant terrible of Scottish writing. He burst on the scene. He wasn't coming from where we thought the writers were coming from, because you're born in Leith, even though it's only a few minutes away from the centre of Edinburgh. What's the story there? How did you fight your way through that assumption?
I don't think you do. I mean, not in the UK. I mean, I think the UK is such a very class-ridden society, and I think the idea was traditionally that you have to, you should have gone to Oxbridge and been kind of, grown up in a kind of room full of stuff with books, and to be a writer, So I mean, it's like kind of, I think it's everything was, you're always kind of sort of fighting against that thing. I mean, it's the first writer I really loved was Evelyn Waugh, and he was my kind of literary hero. And but he came from a totally different place to me.
Why did you love him?
I just loved the way that he drew characters, the psychology of the characters, and the relationships, and that kind of cruel kind of Schadenfreude that existed between characters, which I think really happens, which is part of real life, I think. And I think he nailed that more honestly than just about any writer that I could think of at the time.
Where did you get hold of him?
Through my Uncle Jack, who was... my Uncle Jack was a fireman who did an Open University degree, and he did Evelyn Waugh as part of that, his literature thing. So I used to get all his old bits. I got into Orwell and Evelyn Waugh through my Uncle Jack.
And how did your parents feel about that?
Fair enough. My dad was into... My Uncle Jack would pass the books on to my dad, and my dad passed them on to me, and it's like... I think it was just that kind of culture. I mean, it's like...
well, that's what an open university is supposed to do.
Yeah.
To open up those ideas
It kind of did for us, really, because it was that kind of... I mean, I used to... Books always used to get passed around when I was a kid, but they were usually not... they were usually not great books. It was like kind of Catherine Cookson stuff and all that would come from my Auntie Betty to my mum, and I would read them from, there. But basically, it's like... When Uncle Jack went to the Open University, it meant that the whole family was just getting exposed to different books, basically, and that's what we did. We just read everything that came into the house. It was just that the stuff that came into the house was pretty crap. And then when better stuff started to come into the house, we just got exposed to better stuff, and everybody became a little bit more kind of highbrow in their tastes, I suppose.
But... You didn't go through school and went to university in that trajectory, did you?
Not in that way, no. I mean, I went later on, and I kind of, I got an education in that sense, fairly later after I'd been working for a number of years. But
and tell us the sort of work you were doing, the sort, kind of work you were doing.
All sorts of things, really. I mean, I'm kind of spent long periods on the dole, unemployed, and in London, because all I wanted to do was do music, and I didn't want a 9-to-5 job. So we used to just hang around and jam in our bands and try and get pretty good and try and play gigs at night.
But you were in a band, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in several, but never any good. So I was always
Wasn't good, or you?
I wasn't good. I mean, I was very poor musician. I didn't have a. It was one of these things that I just don't have the dexterity to play things like guitar or keyboards. I mean, the tunes are in my head, but I just can't get them out onto the, through any instrumentation. And I found that very, very sort of difficult. And every time we got to a level of competence, I was always the one that was kind of holding everybody back. So I was kind of kicked out, and I'd join another band, and then they'd get to a level of competence.
Oh, no.
So it was a kind of frustrating thing for me. But I did all sorts of work. I did kind of labouring, building work. I did started to renovate houses and got into stuff that way. I did white collar work. I worked in a library one time, which was quite nice, and I worked for a local authority, and then I worked for the Manpower Services Commission, which ironically was kind of finding employment for long-term unemployed people, of which I'd been fairly recently. Just that these kind of jobs, really, that were that just about everybody seemed to do in Britain in the '80s. I mean, I did a lot of hotel work. I did a lot of did a bit of waiting, which I was no good at. But then I became a short order cook, and chefing was something that I quite liked doing. You know, I liked sort of cooking, and very, you know, it's. I didn't like working in kitchens because I found the heat was very was tough, and in the big industrial kitchens. But
and the pressure.
Yeah, the pressure didn't really bother me. I think you get into a nice sort of rhythm and all that, you know, and you know what you're doing. If it's you know what you're doing. It's just it was good fun, but very very hot and very, you know, sort of the shifts as well. You know, you're sort of. You're basically working where everybody else is playing, which is never much good for me.
So all this time, Irvine Welsh, are you thinking, gee, there's a character, or that's a story?
Not consciously, but I think that I was very much, I've always been that way, you know, I've always been a bit of an observer and a sponge. I take a lot of things, you know, I take a lot of things in. I mean, because I like to talk, I like to talk and can be gabby, but I'm a very good listener as well, you know. And I think as a writer, you have to be, and you have to be interested in people and interested in what's going on around you.
So when did you begin to do the first scratchings and take notes and say, this, I want to tell a story of something?
I think you go from, to me, it was about, like, you know, I used to write songs, and My preference was to write ballads, you know, that kind of told a story. And from then on, you kind of realise that you're not going to do anything as a musician, so that you actually start to write stories. And from then, it was like larger stories and then novels. So I kind of fell into it through that route, basically.
So did you think that writing was not the kind of thing? I'm thinking of this question, that James Kelman was already writing when you began. So, I mean, that's a pretty good model of somebody who wasn't coming from an establishment, even using the language.
I think there always was in Scotland. I mean,
or Alistair Gray.
Yeah, Jim Kelman, Alistair Gray, and then before him, you've got William McIlvany, and you can go right back to kind of James Hogg and even Robert Louis Stevenson. And, you know, people are always kind of... there's, you know, Lewis Grassett Gibbon, you know, there's people, you know, there's always been a divergence in Scottish literature, because there's been that kind of, you know, that kind of oral storytelling tradition of the Celtic oral storytelling tradition has been very influential there, which means that you do get quite a diversity in the way that kind of words are written on the page, the way that things are expressed, the language that's used. So yeah, I mean that very much so. Yeah.
Do you miss that having the sound of that that language in your ear daily? Because, you know, moving to Chicago, you wouldn't hear that much of it.
Yeah, I kind of do in a way, but I think it's like when I get back, and I tend to stay back for come back for a couple of months at a time now because I'm so far away. So I mean, I'll make it worthwhile. And I do get more, I probably get more immersed in it now than I would do if I was just jumping over a couple of times a month on a Ryanair flight from Dublin. So,
but what about the idea of moving into this new place? You know, you've done it a few times now by the sound of it. Is that something that's important to start you off again?
I think so. I just like kind of moving. I mean, it's stressful as well, because I feel now that I'm, you know, like kind of, when you get into your 50s, you can't keep living like a student, you know, and you can't keep living, you know, things being in boxes and all that. So it's quite stressful moving around all the time. But I do it all the time. You know, I keep saying this is the last place I'm going to live in. This is, you know, get this house ideal, and then I'll just move in there and I won't move
again. And
what
drives you out?
I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's just, after a while, I think, well, you know, I love this place, but there's other places that I probably love as well, and I want to see them, so I get off again.
And explore the place?
Yeah, I mean, it's I kind of immerse, that's, you know, rather than explore. I mean, when I was living in Ireland the last 5 years, I mean, I didn't really see that much of the rest of Ireland. I just got immersed in Dublin.
And is it a distraction from writing?
I don't know. I think it informs it as well. I mean, I think that I mean, one thing I think when I wrote crime, for example, about in Miami, I mean, I wrote in a very different way than I normally do a book. I mean, there was a lot of kind of vivid description because I wanted to show this place, this very alien tropical place, through Lennox's eyes, and I probably wouldn't have been able to do that, or I wouldn't have done that if I'd been a native of Miami. I mean, when I write about Edinburgh, I think sometimes I write about it in an over-familiar way and don't kind of set it up as a place enough for readers who are not familiar with it. And I think with this, I was kind of getting off on the way I was kind of like describing Miami, which I don't really do. I don't really like descriptive writing that much. I like things to actually happen and action to take place, and I don't like lots of description getting in the way of the action.
Well, I think you got the balance right. Thank you so much for being on the book show today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the books we've been speaking about are Crime, which is published by Vintage, and Reheated Cabbage, published by Jonathan Cape, both by writer Irvine Welsh.